Gosh, well, thank you very much, Slim, for that kind introduction. And I have to say, I really wanted Slim here today because he's been one of the, or probably the person who's been most influential in my career and helping me get to where I am. So thank you, Slim. I'm very pleased that you could celebrate this occasion with me. So members of the Platform Party, ladies and gentlemen, friends, colleagues, family, I'm really pleased that you could all make it today to help me celebrate this momentous occasion in my life. The people that I've seen that have really evolved from my deep, dark PhD days, which I think is really, really great, and I'm really thrilled to see you, and also the youngsters that made the time, and I hope you can understand what I say, and if you can't, then maybe you should just kind of wave and let me know that it's just not making sense anymore. So it's a great honor to be here today. I'm also pleased to be here at the 100th year celebration of the University of Cape Town Faculty of Health. So for those of you who don't know, the Faculty of Health is the oldest medical school in sub-Saharan Africa. And so this year we are celebrating our 100th year, which you can see in the top corner here. So many of you will be wondering what this title means. And I wanted in this talk, and Slim has alluded to this in some ways in his introduction, I wanted to bring out the two types of pressures that we encounter when we work with HIV. I work with the virus. This is my passion, and this is what gets me out of bed. And I work at trying to understand this relationship between the virus and the host. And as the virus fights to survive, there's intense immune pressure exerted by the host to try and control the virus. However, the second pressure that is on us as researchers working with HIV and also working with HIV-infected people are the societal pressures. Science and politics are very closely interwoven, and we're under a different form of pressure in this way. So I'm going to go through two things, I'm going to go through four things in this talk. Firstly, I'm going to look at tracking the HIV epidemic in South Africa, some of my experiences with HIV denialism, understanding HIV disease progression and vaccines. I'm well aware that this is a general audience, and I'll try and give an overview rather than give you the details. So before I start, I'd like to just up front acknowledge these are the current people within my research group that I work with. We have a fantastic group of students and staff, which you can see over here at a recent outing at Rhodes Memorial. I'm not able to thank and acknowledge them all individually. And I also want to say up front that I'm not able to present all of the magnificent and really exciting work that they're doing. So Daniel Gama, Rueda, I'm not going to say anything about antibodies, which is probably one of the most exciting fields of HIV research today. So Slim has said something about how I got here. I want to first up front acknowledge my parents. This is my mother and father. As Slim indicated, I was born in Zimbabwe. I grew up in Zambia and moved here, in fact, in my high school years. My father he was a dentist, but he had a much greater passion for plants and natural history than he did, in fact, have for teeth. So, and my mother was a teacher, but really a great supporter for all of us children. There were four of us, and I'm the fourth daughter. I think they gave up after me. So I want to really thank them and acknowledge them for my great upbringing that really gave me the skills that I needed to succeed in my later life. Okay, so to get down to my academic history, I did my PhD in the 80s. This was a time of great turbulence in South Africa. There was an ongoing armed struggle. There was mass mobilization. We were going through things like the meat boycott, which wouldn't have done too well nowadays for those of you on the Atkins diet. There was bad pop music, bad hairstyles, but also this was the era in which HIV was discovered, or the decade which HIV was discovered. However, at that time, I was working on my PhD, and the central question in my PhD was, can you use viruses to control agricultural pests, and I'm very pleased to say that my one of my inspirational PhD supervisors is here, Barbara van Beekma, and Ed Rubitsky, who I didn't know at the time but was subsequently to become my brother-in-law. So I don't know, Peter Buckton, if you remember, we grew and watched Peter's here. This is the bug that I worked on. It's an aphid. And we spend many days, many nights growing these little animals. You might recognize them from your garden. They're a severe pest of agricultural pest. And Barbara, through her astute observation within nature and biology and her connections with the farming with farmers, I guess, and the farming industry, found this colony of aphids, which she saw were behaving rather unusually. So they were moving away from their food and becoming uncoordinated in their movement, and apparent paralysis developed, followed by death. And so she brought these back to the lab. We grew them up, looked at them, extracted them, and we're thrilled to find that the thing that was causing this unusual behavior in these aphids was a new virus, which we called aphid lethal paralysis virus. In my postdoc, we discovered two further new viruses, this time affecting the green stink bug, and you'll see an adult and a juvenile over here, and which we called Nazara virulovirus virus 1 and 2. However, this was also a sentinel time in what was to become the greatest viral epidemic in current times. So you can see in the 80s, so these maps in Africa show the severity of the HIV epidemic in the different years. And you can see in the 80s, the darker the color, the more severe the epidemic. In the mid-80s, the colors, I guess, were a bit muted. However, by the end of the decade, by 1989, you can see there's some countries in Africa where the epidemic was hitting them pretty hard, particularly Zambia, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, and Uganda. However, you'll also notice that South Africa at this time was relatively untouched, with prevalences below 1%. However, as you all know, that this was not to last. And in this graph over here shows the percentage of women, pregnant women in government antenatal clinics who were HIV positive. And you can see the exponential growth of the HIV epidemic in the 90s, from less than 1% in the 1990 to nearly a third of women attending antenatal clinics being HIV positive. In some areas where we work, up to 50% of women are HIV positive. South Africa has the most number of infections of any country globally, and we also have one of the highest prevalences. So it was about in this time, in the very early epidemic, that I was recruited by the South African Institute for Medical Research, specifically by John Moody, who was a really inspirational virologist in his time, to work on HIV. He realized at that time that HIV was going to become a problem. So this is the virus that I work, that I've spent 20 years working on. This is a depiction of a T cell in green, and you can see these little red blobs, which is the virus blobbing out of or budding out of the cell. And over here is what the virus looks like. So while a clinician will look at signs and symptoms to try and understand disease, what I do or what my group does in the lab is look at the virus and try and understand how that virus is causing disease. And we do this primarily because we would like to contribute towards an intervention that can somehow stop this epidemic. So this is the nuts and bolts of what we do, and it looks, I'm sure, like a bunch of squiggles to the uninitiated, but this is in fact the genetic sequence of the virus. And what you can do by sequencing the virus, which is our sort of fundamental tool that we use, is you can decode the sequence and work out what are the proteins that are being made by the virus, and in turn a whole lot of proteins make up the virus, and it tells us what the virus looks like. Another tool that we use in the types of research we do are looking at phylogenetic trees. Some of you might have participated in the National Geographic study which was looking at human ancestry. So this is the same thing, except it's looking at the relationships and the ancestry of viruses. And I'm using this illustration partly inspired because my father's a botanist, but also I thought it was a great way to understand how to interpret phylogenetic trees. So this is a cactus, and just imagine that you go out to the desert, and it can't be an African desert because cacti don't grow in Africa, and you see this and you measure it, the cacti 1 year. You come back sometime later and you see that it's grown a little bit taller and it's diversified out. It's got a whole lot of branches. You can tell by measuring how much this cacti has grown, you can deduce when this cacti actually took root. And doing phylogenetic trees for viruses might look a little bit more complicated, but it's not very different to that. So if you look over here, for example, well, firstly, just to say that HIV as a virus evolves incredibly fast and has diversified within the population. And this myriad of colors illustrates how different the virus has become as it has evolved through human population. But if we just look at this group over here, for example, you know that somewhere over here was the great-great grandparent of this set of viruses. And then all of these, you can imagine, are cousins and second cousins and related to each other. And they're very much more distantly related to this group of viruses over here, and with the length of this branch being really important as to estimating how different the viruses are from each other. So people have used this kind of approach to track the HIV epidemic globally, and they've also used this approach to look at where HIV originated. So from published studies, we know that HIV moved from this animal here, the chimpanzee, into humans around the beginning of the last century. We also know that this event occurred somewhere in central equatorial Africa. People have tracked the viruses that have moved around the world and identified that this epidemic that first actually heralded or brought our attention to the existence of HIV and AIDS occurred through the single introduction of the virus into Haiti and then into the USA, and then subsequently the virus spread globally. In Africa, about 50 years after the transmission event into humans, you see evidence of the spread of the virus into different regions of Africa. However, at this time, and when I started working on HIV, we didn't have any idea as to what was happening in South Africa. So this brings me to the first component of the talk, is tracking the HIV epidemic in South Africa. Just to remind you, the first cases of AIDS were described in 1981 in the USA. In 1983, the first two cases of AIDS were reported in South Africa in men who have sex with men, and this is the scientific term that we use for transmission in male homosexual couples. In 1983 was also the year where HIV was identified as the etiological agent causing AIDS. However, so this was the early and the first cases of HIV detected in South Africa. However, in 1988, we started to detect HIV in women, heralding the start of a second epidemic, which was transmitted through heterosexual transmission. So what we did in these very early studies was collect samples from people who became infected between 1986 and 1983. And we found that in the MSM population, the major subtype that was occurring in these people was subtype B virus. If you remember, subtype B is the virus that that we had seen that was transmitted to America and across the world. And so what this data tells you is that the virus was reintroduced back into Africa, either from Europe and America, and behavioral data collected by Robin Wood, who had the AIDS clinic at the time, supported this in that many of these infected individuals had a history of high-risk sexual behaviour while visiting either Europe or America. So what about the heterosexual population? So we find in this population the predominant virus was subtype C. So what do we know about the subtype C virus? Well, other studies have shown that subtype C moved from the epicenter of the original epidemic into Central Africa around the 1950s. At the time of doing the study, it was the predominant subtype in Zambia, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Botswana. And what our study then showed was that the second epidemic in heterosexuals didn't come from the earlier epidemic that was in the MSM population. However, it came through multiple introductions of subtype C into the heterosexual epidemic through regional spread. So we've gone on to look at viruses for the last 10 to 15 years, and because diversity is important for vaccine development. And this just shows a large number of viruses that we've collected from recently infected individuals from all over the country. And we've shown that the subtype C epidemic remains dominant in the heterosexual population in South Africa. However, we are seeing the introduction of other subtypes, such as subtype A, and some of these mosaic viruses, which are a combination of subtype A, of different subtypes, for example, a CA recombinant and a CB recombinant. I'm going to switch tack a little bit and look at HIV denialism in South Africa. I'm going to use some cartoons from Jonathan Shapira, who I'm sure you're all very familiar with him. He's a brilliant satirist who's able to capture key events in politics in South Africa. So somewhere in the late 1990s, things started to go seriously wrong in the HIV health policy in South Africa. While the rest of the world was celebrating the discovery of new drugs that could treat HIV, and there was also evidence to show that you could prevent babies from becoming infected with HIV from their mothers, South Africa was looking at some other solutions. And the primary question that our then president, Mbeki, was asking was if there was in fact a causal link between HIV and AIDS. And I can see there's some of you in the room that are really familiar with this period. It was a very dark period in, I think, the South African history. Essentially, President Mbeki set up this advisory panel of so-called international experts along with some conventional scientists to ask this question whether HIV caused AIDS. And these are some of the issues that we had to deal with. So this shows Mbeki and our ex-minister Mantu Shabalala in Simang going along the dissident highway despite all the warnings that they were going the wrong way. It was a cul-de-sac. It was likely to happen in, to end in disaster. Nevertheless, they still thought these issues were worth debating. So it was an absolute scientific fact at the time with just mountains of evidence that HIV caused AIDS. But somehow, through the cruising of wacko websites and discussions with alternative scientists who could have belonged to the Flat Earth Society, our ex-president came up with these questions as to whether does HIV cause AIDS? Should we use AZT given well, evidence that he thought that indicated it was too toxic for use. This is the drug that you use to prevent babies from becoming infected. So what many people don't know, just to say that there was never resolution or consensus on that panel. I think eventually it was decided that he needed to just be quiet and withdraw from the debate, and it kind of disappeared. But the what most people don't know is that there was a second phase of the HIV denialist period, and that was to draft the ultimate experiment to prove that in fact the tests that we were using to pick up HIV were not really picking up the virus, but they were picking up something else. And there were all sorts of theories by the denialists as to what this might be, the huge burden of disease in Africa, strange sexual behaviours, malnutrition, and a lot of offensive things that were put forward. And I wanted to share with you this choice email that I got from one of the denialists, just to give an example of the types of things that we had to deal with. So Harvey Bialy was one of the major protagonists of the denialist group, and you'll see here some of your favorite friends as well as some of the denialists like Raznik. So this was an email in response to the so-called experiment that they had designed and which I had extensively corrected and given suggestions, where he writes, "Carolyn, your arrogance is only matched by your ignorance. Brands me as thick-skinned. He can't control it any longer, and he has to berate me in front of the entire panel, saying once more to be taken to task and have your naughty little wrists slapped yet again." It was just a bizarre experience, I have to say, and like living in an alternative universe. But it obviously had extremely serious repercussions as far as South Africa goes. And over here you see our ex-minister of health announcing the roll out of antiretrovirals, saying, "I know you've all been waiting a long time for this," and a whole series of people who have died while they've been waiting. And it was estimated by a group of Harvard researchers that as many as nearly a third of a million people died because of the delay by government to implement antiretrovirals in the country. So I'm going to move on from the type of political pressure that we had to work on back into science, and my true passion in life is looking and trying to understand the virus. And here I'm going to look at HIV disease progression. So the questions that we were asking when we started the study, and this is the study that Slim mentioned in his introduction, the acute infection study, where we had enrolled a whole lot of HIV recently infected women to try and understand disease progression. And the questions we were asking is, how fast do people progress? Is it the same in South Africa as Europe and America? How do people control the virus? And can we use this information for vaccine design? And why do people progress at different rates? Just to introduce you to the natural history of HIV infection so you can understand some of this. So essentially, this looks at infection over time. So if you get HIV, if you get infected with HIV at time zero over here, the virus replicates for a while locally, then disseminates into the body, and you get a huge amount of virus produced, which you see here as this curve going up. The immune system then kicks in, brings the virus under control for a variable amount of period, but on average in US and European studies about 9 years, until the body essentially loses the battle and your viral load goes up and a person develops AIDS. This is what happens to the CD4 count. So this is the other marker in which you use to work out how people are progressing to disease. So on infection, you get this massive drop in CD4 count. So up to about 60% of CD4s are in fact lost following infection in the cohort that we've been looking at. And then you get this marching downwards of the CD4 cells over time until the development of AIDS. So this is the Caprisa acute infection study that we set up. It recruits from two areas in South Africa, from Durban, as well as a rural site, Vulindlela. And this is a real example of what we see in these women. So this is the first 62 women that were enrolled in the study, looking over a year. I know it may look a little complicated to some people, but I want you just to look at this red line over here. So in these individuals, you see this huge loss of CD4 counts, and it continues to go down. the black line is the time in which people need to initiate therapy. So this is up to 1 year. And what we find is that nearly 25% of these women needed to initiate therapy according to the current guidelines within a year of infection. So this type of research has huge public health implications in informing estimates of how many people are going to need to access treatment in South Africa. This is done in one cohort and probably needs to be done in other cohorts in order to generalize this data. The other group of people in this study that we focused on is this group over here. So here now I'm looking at the viral loads. So if you're infected with HIV, you want to keep your viral loads down because that's high viral loads is what's destroying your immune system. So this is a good thing if your viral load is down. And these individuals were found to control their virus replication very well. And we find that about 14% of people belong to this group, the HIV controllers. And we're really interested in this group because we hope that they will give us clues as to what we need to do with a vaccine in order to get people to control the virus. However, lots of people have been looking at factors associated with the control of virus. It's a very complicated issue, the pathogenesis of HIV infection. But what we do know is one of the most important things is your host genes. So unfortunately, it is something that you are born with, and the immune response that you develop. And what happens is this cat and mouse game between the immune response and the virus, where a person gets a response and the virus changes and escapes that immune response. The immune response adapts to try and control the virus and it escapes to go again. And this continues on and on throughout infection. So in the CAPRISA cohort, what we were really interested in was looking at this very early stage of infection. So this is the same natural history graph that I showed earlier. What we're interested in is what is this virus that's being transmitted, knowing that it changes a lot as you go through disease, and also what is happening over here that is enabling people to control infection. So in studies that we've done in South Africa, as well as cohorts from Tanzania, what we found is that in individuals, even if there are millions of particles deposited at the surface of the mucosa, for example, in the vaginal cavity, only one virus is in fact moving across in 80% of cases. Only one virus is moving across to establish infection. So what it means is it's actually quite hard to become infected, but also that microbicides and vaccines that we're trying to develop to prevent infection only really need to get that one virus, despite that both of those interventions have been incredibly hard to develop. Over time, once the virus becomes established, and once you have HIV, you have it for life, you get this, the virus replicates at an incredible rate, and because every time it replicates, it makes mistakes, it actually changes how it looks over time. And I've tried to illustrate this change by showing the myriad of colors that the virus changes into. So what happens is that soon after infection, the host mounts an immune response to try and eliminate the virus. The virus, as I've said, tries to avoid this immune pressure. And when we're looking at the virus sequence, so I showed you the sequence in the beginning of the talk and what we do to map what's happening with the virus. So when you look at the viral sequence, whatever's happening in the host is actually imprinted on that virus sequence. And by reading the viral sequence, you can tell what's happening within an infected person. So it's an incredibly powerful tool. This is actually real data, so just look at the pattern. Every line here is a virus. It's a whole genome of a virus. So every line represents a virus. Every stripe represents a change. And this is the time points in which we've sampled. So at 2 weeks, this person's infected with only a single virus, so you see only very few changes. You get more changes, and then time goes on, you just get more and more changes. So what does this mean? So I've given you this example. So a lot of these changes may just be random, and we need to differentiate what's a random change and what's a meaningful change. And this is how we do it. Right, so this is again across the whole genome. All the stripes are different viruses. Just look at the pattern. You can see there's a lot going on in this person. And the grey and blue stripes are the changes that are occurring due to immune pressure. So this individual happens to be a rapid disease progressor and has lots of changes. This individual, you can see there's much less happening, a lot fewer stripes and a lot fewer grey and blue bars, suggesting that there's a lot less happening in this individual and the virus isn't really managing to escape immune detection. So you'd be tempted to say, well, escape is really bad and it's bad for a person. And in fact, you would be right if you came to that conclusion, but only to a certain extent. So we do have evidence that even a single change in a single epitope, which is the region targeted by the immune response, can result in a tenfold increase in the amount of virus in the body. So this tells you that escape is bad news. However, nothing's simple with HIV. And us and actually many investigators have found that certain mutations, in fact, cause the virus to lose its ability to replicate. So they affect the viral fitness. So even if the virus escapes, your viral load doesn't really go up very much. And we found that if people get infected with these less fit viruses, that they have a survival advantage. So what we think is going on is that you get infected with HIV, you have immune pressure very early in infection, and if the virus escapes from the immune system, this is bad news. However, in some individuals, if you've got good HLA alleles, then and you don't escape, this is, and you've got a good response, this is good news. If you do escape, but you escape in these particular regions that affect the viral fitness, then you're not as bad off as this person who manages to have escape, which is bad. But in truth, although I've simplified it, it's really complicated and there's a whole lot of different things going on and we don't really understand all the reasons which make people a fast progressor or a slow progressor, and this is still an area of intense research. So I'm going to end off by talking about vaccines. So vaccines is our ultimate weapon to control the HIV epidemic. This has been shown effectively in smallpox, where vaccines were shown to be able to eliminate a viral disease from the world. In diseases like polio, where vaccines have largely controlled viral epidemics. In HIV, it's been very difficult to develop a vaccine despite 25 years or so of intense effort and huge amounts of money globally into this field of research. So vaccines go through many different phases before you work out whether they work or not. You go through a phase one, which is a safety, a phase two, which is essentially looking at how well they elicit responses, and a phase three, which is the only time you can work out if a vaccine works. So these list the different vaccine trials that have happened globally, and you'll see immediately that they're not very many. And this is because it's an incredibly difficult and expensive process to get through to a phase three efficacy trial. You have to pass a whole lot of both scientific hoops to believe the vaccine's going to work, as well as regulatory hoops. However, a couple of years ago, the results of the Thai trial came out and showed this modest protection effect. So this was really exciting, not because this is a great result, but it tells us that a vaccine is possible. But we have to do better. My interest, as you might must know by now, is looking at the virus, and I don't want you to understand anything about that for people who don't spend their time looking at trees, but just look at the size of the circle. So the size of the circle tells you how diverse the virus is, and you can see this is the size of the global diversity of the HIV epidemic. This is the size of the global diversity in 1 year of a flu epidemic. So the flu epidemic, you change vaccines every year, and you can just imagine for HIV what a challenge genetic diversity is. So pretty early on in the epidemic, after we characterized a predominantly subtype C epidemic in South Africa and found it was different to the virus circulating in the US and Europe, where at that stage most of the research was being done, we motivated to get our viruses essentially into different vaccines around the world. And this is the consortium of people that worked on this project, Ron Swanstrom, Lynn Morris, who's become a very close collaborator, and Slim. So we designed these vaccine immunogens, which have gone into a number of vaccines. The VEE vaccine, which has been tested in the US, but also was also the first vaccine trial in South Africa. The AAV vaccine developed by Targeted Genetics that was tested in India and Europe. And then our very own homemade vaccine, the DNA MVA vaccine, which was tested in the USA and South Africa. And I'm going to say a little bit more about this program here. So this is the team that Annelise set up in the early 2000s through funding through the South African AIDS Vaccine Initiative to develop locally relevant vaccines. Quite early on in this process, the scientific advisory board that was made up of a lot of really prominent international experts advised that we should go forward with one of our vaccine candidates. So we selected these two candidates, the DNA vaccine and the, oh my goodness, sorry Annelise, this should say MVA vaccine, so of which we were co-developers. So we went from constructing and designing and making these vaccines, and I can't tell you what the long path is that this era represents, probably 6 years of our lives, to get the vaccine through regulatory review, animal testing, and into these vials for testing in humans. The first human trial was launched a couple of years ago, and you can see Annelise over here, plus our ex-Minister of Health, who sadly passed away shortly. Sorry, he was Deputy Minister of Health shortly after that, and some other prominent international figures. Taking a vaccine to clinical trial is a huge effort, and this is a picture of the preclinical team just at UCT, and some of the key players that have been involved in testing this vaccine. So this vaccine is really a very exciting and I think a huge achievement for us, because it's the first vaccine that was developed in Africa that was taken from Africa and tested in were taken into human trials and tested both in Africa and in the US. And it's more recently gone into much larger phase one clinical trials, so it's gone into the second phase of testing. So I want to end off my talk now, just to return back to the original title that I had for the talk, Surviving Under Immense Pressure. So I hope in this talk that you somehow understand a little bit more about the virus, for those of you who are not biologists, that I've shown you that the virus rapidly evolves to escape immune pressure, and that we can use this to track the origin, or we have used this to track the origin of the epidemics in South Africa. That sometimes the virus wins this battle and people progress faster. Sometimes people control the virus, and in fact they can live for very long periods of time, 20 to 30 years without drugs. And studying these people can provide us with clues on how to make an effective vaccine. Also, this research, I think, has an added credit, I guess, in that we've been able to translate our research findings both into informing public health decisions around treatment, but also future interventions such as vaccines. From a society perspective, although the mistakes of the past are now being corrected and we have an aspirational new Minister of Health who has many new ideas on how to contend with the epidemic, the epidemic is severe. It's putting huge pressure on us as a country and as well as us as individuals to try and find a solution. And I think the solution ultimately, although it's not quite in our grasp yet, is the discovery of an effective HIV vaccine, which can only be done through scientific innovation, extensive collaboration, but has incredible power to save millions of lives and actually has the power to get rid of this epidemic altogether. I'm going to end off now with some acknowledgements, and I'm not going to thank everybody because it's just too many people and I'll miss out, I'm sure, in a whole lot. But I do just want to acknowledge and thank Annelise, who's my sister. She's been a great advisor over the years, and her help and discussions have really been incredibly valuable in my career. Debbie, who manages to help me keep everything together. Lynn Morris, Clive Bray, and of course Slim. But mostly I would like to thank the participants who have enabled us to do these studies and gave of themselves and their time to contribute to science. So this is my last slide, and I really want to pay tribute to my family, especially Tim Tucker. This is both of us on a recent motorbiking holiday that I've recently taken up as a hobby. And Tim is my life partner. He's my best friend and just a fantastic support in my life. So thank you, Tim, for that. Our wonderful children, Claire, Annabelle, Holly, and Daniel. And a special thanks to acknowledgement of Daniel and Annabelle, who when they were little and I was working so hard and traveling so much, they never ever once complained. So thank you.